Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by Heritage Foods, an online and wholesale distributor of heritage breed meat and poultry. Learn more at heritagefoods.com.
I'm HRN's Communications Director Kat Johnson with a preview of this week's episode of Meat in 3, our weekly food news roundup. Fall is finally here, so it's time to get funky and devote an episode to some of our favorite spunky microbes.
Fungi just provide this beautiful, whimsical lens on how the world works. They have so many roles. They're this strange and magical-seeming group of organisms, but they've got it all figured out.
Should you eat the cheese rind? Can you eat the rind? These are like the biggest questions.
We'll answer all of your questions about mysterious mushrooms and crazy curds. Plus, we'll give you a sneak listen to the newest season of Modernist Breadcrumbs. So tune in to this week's Meat in 3 on Heritage Radio Network, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome to the Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkell. And on today's episode, a modern-day Johnny Appleseed spreads the story of cider. Annie Bistrin, founder and president of Cider in Love, a curated online marketplace for fine heritage ciders, brings small-batch cideries right to your door. And I'm also joined by Jordan Werner Berry, our host of Modernist Breadcrumbs, because she has a master's in cider. And I've always been intimidated by your cider knowledge and everything that you do for Cider Week, which is coming next week, and we'll give a little information about that. But I thought we should have a meeting of the minds about apples in general. Let's define, first of all, what cider even is.
So cider is an alcoholic beverage from fermented apples. Jordan, do you agree?
Yes.
Excellent. And it's one of the most... It's one of the most storied beverages out there, to be honest. It dates back to the ancient Romans. And in this country, it's really the first alcoholic, boozy beverage that takes off. When the English colonists come over here, the vines don't work. It's too cold. So they bring over some apples, and they get going. And obviously, where they landed would happen to be fabulous apple-growing territory.
And it was potable. It was probably safer to drink that than the groundwater.
Absolutely. So, you know, obviously, I think if you're living in freezing cold with no indoor plumbing, you probably want a glass to drink anyway. But not to mention, it's useful for baptisms. It's useful for just daily drinking and making sure that, you know, you're staying healthy. An apple a day.
For baptisms, is it just the L'chaim that happens afterwards?
If you have to like dunk a baby, there are legends that that has happened.
Yeah. So Jordan, not to put you on the spot, but when and if you have children, is it going to be a cider baptism, cider?
Absolutely. Okay. That sounds great. Doesn't that sound good? It's like, just get a couple cases. Yeah. Done.
I mean, some of these childhood stories that you hear about apples and cider, like Johnny Appleseed, mm-hmm. is there a truth to that?
Johnny Appleseed is a historical figure. I think the piece that gets lost in the elementary school education is there's this idea of this sort of mythical figure, and he just really wants people to eat apples, whereas the story is a lot more complex, and it has two pieces. So I love this show because I can geek out a little, so welcome to some geekdom. First is that as settlers are moving from the East Coast through the West, the Midwest, there's this real desire to get the land settled. And the United States government was essentially giving away parcels of land if you could show that you were really going to stay put. And a way you could show you were staying put was by planting apple trees, because apple trees take 5 years to produce fruit, and so that was a good proxy. So then suddenly there was this real interest in apple trees to help politically settle a huge geography. And then Johnny Appleseed emerges, who's a very complicated figure, and he had, I'm going to totally mangle his his religion, but he belonged to a particular church that did not believe in grafting. It was against his religion. So he grew apples into nurseries from seed. Like, he grew baby apples and created them directly, you know, brought them to people, little plants or their little saplings, or he grew them in nurseries. Those wild apple seeds were really cider apples. They were not going to be eating apples, because when you grow from seed, quite often what you're getting is something we call a spitter. So, not for your pie.
Those are those little, small, tart, almost crab apple-looking things.
There's so many different types. You know, the truth is, there are crab apples are actually indigenous to the North America, but a lot of cider-specific apples, my God, there are thousands of them. They come in all different shapes, sizes, colors. Some are small, some are not small, but a lot of them fall into what people call the bitter sharp or the bitter sweet world, and they are so intense in terms of the acid and the tannic structure that truly when you bite into them, you will spit it out.
So was there this diversity with Johnny Appleseed, mm-hmm. better known as John Chapman from Leominster, Massachusetts, who seemed more like a land baron than he did somebody that was promoting hard cider?
I think that, you know, the mythology of apples in this country runs deep. And to really understand it, you need to back up and just understand cider is America's original beverage with very little beverage diversity. This is really what people were drinking almost exclusively in the, let's call it, middle of the road alcohol realm. And so, yeah, he has an incredibly important role in terms of acting as a catalyst for westward expansion. But I think he also was 100% passionate about what he was doing with apple trees and growing them from seed. You couldn't discount that.
Well, let's talk about where cider was originally drank and the cultures around the world. Mm. Apples being originally from Kazakhstan,
indeed,
quite possibly.
Yes.
Is there a drinking culture there?
Well, I can't speak to it too distinctly, although I have been to Kazakhstan and I have been to Almaty, and I can tell you they have endless photos and posters of apples there, but I did not see a very large cider scene there. It seems to have come along the trading routes and really sort of taken hold originally in the confines of the Roman Empire. We hear stories of Romans using olive presses to press apples, but where you really see it start to take hold is a little further north, where the climate makes more sense as part of the Roman Empire. So that's, we're looking at France, we're looking at Spain, we're looking at the UK, which have some of the most incredible and really historic apple cultures, and specifically cider cultures that go back. I mean, I would hate to even put a date on it. Centuries.
It's been fantastic to see the proliferation of certain cuisines like Basque cuisine in mm-hmm. New York, that we're seeing this influx of cider on menus.
Yeah.
I don't know if there are any, you know, Normandy restaurants or, you know, French restaurants that are specifically northern, but what is the cuisine like associated with those ciders, and is that part of the vehicle that helps people drink more cider?
I think one of the things we know about cider in general and cider in the United States is we know there's a very deep correlation between cider and food, and we can talk about those reasons why specifically that beverage works. Historically, various cultures will create a culture around it that ties to it. I can give you an example in Normandy, where you have apple trees growing in a way that we can't grow them here, where you have cows actually underneath the apple tree. So it talk about terroir. You are making a, let's say, a camembert from a cow that was eating, you know, right underneath an apple tree, and then you're making cider that you serve with that camembert. I mean, I can't think of anything sort of more beautiful and delicious together.
Let's talk about apple varieties for a second, because we have been talking about cider, and it's obviously made of that fruit, but the ones I know best are like Gala, Fuji,
yeah,
Granny Smith,
Granny
Macintosh.
Smith. Yeah, yeah.
And I know there are some ciders that are made with those, but let's talk about these heritage apples, mm-hmm. You know, what you're trying to focus more on, Dabinets, Kinks and Blacks. What, there are like 10,000 varieties of apples, so the two of you can fill in all the rest. Go
yeah.
ahead. Back and forth.
Well, I mean, what I'll first start by saying for like the average Joe listening to this, because when we are doing events and we bring people into the world of heritage cider, the thing that we kind of straight up say to them is like, look, there's a difference between a Concord grape and a Pinot Noir grape, because you're not asking for grape, you know, Welch's grape juice, you know, when you go out to a wine bar. You know that there's a difference. And what that implicitly tells us is we know there's a difference between high quality fruit and beverages. So what we're talking about when we say cider-specific apples, it's not a false fanciness. It's really to say there are apples that have a quality and characteristics that simply produce product that really is, has the same sophistication and nuance and complexity as a wine. So cider-specific apples, and sometimes they're heirloom apples that can do double duty, usually have a far more complexity to them, and therefore render a cider that they call heritage. It's actually a cider industry-wide term. We know modern ciders are made from eating apples, and you can make cider from any apple. But if you're working with these cider-specific apples that have higher levels of tannins or acids, they will create a heritage cider. And just for people to kind of get a sense of, because we made the Pinot Noir reference, it's not always single varietal. Oftentimes, most ciders are actually going to be a blend of many different cider apples. And then you have wild apples, which are, and crab apples. But if you talk about wild apples, those are all snowflakes. Each one is completely unique. So I can't even, how many thousands of those are there? Oh, who knows?
Yeah.
Right, Jordan?
Totally. And I was just up in Vermont at Windfall Orchard, and we had... They have some wild apples that they've grafted onto trees.
Oh, amazing.
And so we had the same wild apple, but from its wild version, mm-hmm. from Sunrise Orchards as a grafted tree and from Windfall as a grafted tree. And we cut them all open. And even just the subtle differences, this is how we can really start, I think, to talk about terroir, mm-hmm. is, yes, it's a wild snowflake apple that nothing else is like, but the influence of even just grafting or mm-hmm. grafting into a specific orchard with those apples was blowing my mind. The wild one, we cut it open and it oxidized immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And the other two didn't.
So fascinating. Yeah. I mean, my experience with wild apple picking, you know, it was one of the reasons I really wanted to dive into this as I was working. I went up to meet Steve Sellin at South Hill up in Ithaca. And, you know, I went at the perfect time of year. It was just the beginning of the harvest season. And, you know, he took me out foraging. And it's amazing to go to some of these sort of forgotten apple trees or lost apple trees. And, you know, the sun was perfect. The sun was, you know, just dying over the hill. And we were just grabbing apples, not even an orchard, an overgrown hedgerows, and just biting and eating. And there was this real sense of discovery and nuance. And I think, to your point, that's happening in the apple industry and the cider apple industry extensively right now. How is something that grows a known cider apple in the Northeast, how is that growing in California? Different flavor profiles emerge. So yeah, terroir is something that I think a lot of folks new to cider have not even considered, which is not to say that cider is wine. Cider deserves its own separate seat at the table, but wine offers some interesting benchmarks to think about. You know, terroir is important with fruit, so why wouldn't you think it's true with cider and apples?
So I think what I'm understanding is that if I plant 50 apple trees somewhere, I own that land. This is a really important thing here in New York in the real estate market.
But I think they may have changed yeah. the law, so you should check yeah. first.
Well, on that, we're going to take a quick break and come back and actually talk about the parallels of wine and cider language. You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Heritage Foods. Heritage Foods was founded to sell ancient breeds of livestock and poultry that were becoming extinct, largely because industrial agriculture willfully pushed healthy heritage breeds aside for more profitable, faster-growing animals. Rare heritage breeds are saved when popular demand increases and farmers have the incentive to raise them. This Thanksgiving, we encourage you to buy a turkey from Frank Reese's Good Shepherd Poultry Ranch. Frank's turkeys are 100% purebred heritage, 100% pasture-raised, and 100% antibiotic-free. Turkeys are available in 2-pound increments. You choose your size. Don't wait. Pre-order your Heritage Thanksgiving turkey today at heritagefoods.com.
Hey, welcome back to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. If you've been listening, you've been listening to a lot of cider talk. I might just rename the show Cider Talk from now on. But the amazing thing about hearing of how apple and fermented apple juice proliferated, it's very parallel to how we speak about wine. And I know, Jordan, you for years have studied this cider language. Mm-hmm. And let's kind of delve into what cider language is and how to navigate mm-hmm. just even the website, Cider in Love, if I was a novice, which I am, on what to purchase, how to taste that, and what we're about to taste on air.
Well, I think, you know, as I'm pouring, so hold on, I'm going to make the fun sound of uncorking this cider while we're going. Cider in Love is the only online curator of heritage cider, so we work directly with small independent farmers who are really talented across the country, and we work like Etsy. You know, It comes directly from the orchard to your door. And what we wanted to do was make it easy for people who are new to cider. So when you go onto the site, you can actually shop by, there's a shopping filter. So you can shop by dry to sweet. You can, P.S. not all cider tastes like melted Jolly Ranchers. Most heritage cider actually is quite dry. You can shop by still to sparkling. There are still ciders. I think a lot of people aren't aware of that. And most importantly, you can shop by note. So cider does not always taste like apples, nor does wine taste like grapes all the time. So what notes attract you? Are you attracted to citrus flavors? Are you attracted to floral flavors? What about smoky notes, earthy notes, oaky notes. So we have a lot of fun stuff to actually taste, and we'll try to maybe describe it for those tuning in so they can get a sense of what's out there. Because it's probably what we find is a lot of people are surprised when they taste heritage cider. That's the number one reaction we get, which is, whoa, I thought I didn't like cider, or I thought it was sweet, and whoa, I didn't even know this was out there. And so that's the fun part, the discovery.
And it's out there throughout the U.S. And even though your locations are only New York, Northwest, New England, California on the site, apples grow all across this great nation. My mm-hmm. wife's from Michigan, and we go up to northern Michigan every summer.
Oh, great and the apple culture.
Yeah, and the cideries are bonkers and so quaffable. Where are the major wine-growing regions, cider-growing regions in the States?
Although, interestingly, there are parallels. I was just pouring a glass, excuse me. The major regions that you're looking at are obviously, I have to say it first, we're in New York State. New York City Cider Week is starting. So New York State, the Big Apple, there's a connection. The New England, obviously, Vermont, Massachusetts, there's some great cider makers all throughout the Northeast. As well as down into the Mid-Atlantic, you're looking at Pennsylvania, Virginia, North Carolina. There is a sort of warmth thing going on there. Apple trees don't proliferate as well as, say, orange trees in Florida, so that's a little bit of a change. Then in the Midwest, you've got some great makers who are going to be all through Wisconsin and Michigan, and then again, you get this big hub. It's not to say there aren't cider makers across the country. There are, but there's another fabulous hub in Colorado, yes, and then also Washington is really well known. It's the biggest apple-growing state in the country. Traditionally commercial, but there's so many people doing great heritage ciders out there, and we'll be able to taste one of theirs, too.
It was wild. I was just out in Seattle, and 5 years ago, I went to Taste Washington, mm-hmm. and it was a wine convention, and now it has blended into a wine and cider one.
Yeah.
Because cider has become such a big and supporting part of the drinking culture there.
Yeah. It's really fun. I've been able, part of the way that we built this site is I got in a car and road trip to everybody's individual farm. So everybody on our site, we've actually gone, visited them, seen their orchards, seen their apples, and talked to them about how they make it.
So I'm going to sit back and drink, and the two of you can just talk about the tasting notes of this, or how to actually go through tasting a cider and what the language is around describing it.
Well, I think it's very similar to the process that people know from tasting wine, even mm-hmm. from like a wine 101. It's what do you smell? What do you see? What's the color? What's the effervescence? Mm-hmm. And then what do you notice in it that tastes like other things that you know? And I guess I'm really intrigued by the fact that you have listed and searchable tasting notes mm-hmm. on the site. Are you coming up with those, or are those?
Oh, yeah. No, well, I came up with those, and then I worked with collaborators. So I worked with several cider makers in the industry, including Dan from Slyborough and Eric from Redbird and Meredith Collins, who writes about cider up in Ithaca. And we kind of worked on them together. You know, my background's in marketing, so I kind of, you know, what I'm trying to do is take a great deal of intense cider knowledge and then make it accessible for the consumer so that the geeking out also is accessible. One of the things I love about cider is, you know, no matter how much I taste wine, I always feel a little stupid. Cider is unfussy and yet offers all the same amount of complexity. So it is kind of what you make it. You know, yeah, stick your nose in there, taste it, take some time to taste it with some different foods, but don't be afraid to name a note that's not on the label. You know, that's what speaks to you. Taste is a profoundly intimate and personal thing. And there's just a huge amount of variety. I think that if I had one message for today is open your eyes to the incredible diversity of what Heritage Cider is, because we have ciders on the site that are extraordinarily tart and then ones that are crisp and zingy. And then we have ones that are loaded with notes of vanilla and smoke and oak and everything in between, including Barnyard Funk, which is some people's thing.
Yeah, I love how dry this one is.
Yeah, so this one is, just to give Steve his due credit, this is Pack Basket Sparkling We're Sipping. This is made right outside Ithaca by Steve Sellen out in South Hill. And I was talking about wild apples. This is called Pack Basket because Steve is actually foraging these apples, and the only way for him to get them home is for him to put them into a basket and carry them home. So that's why it's named Pack Basket. And it's a real expression of terroir. It's both dry but aromatic. You really get a sense of this is a time and a place and a landscape in a glass. And that's what really drew me to cider, this idea of connecting in a really meaningful way with something that's quite authentic. I didn't want to work with mass producers. I wanted to work with people who really made their living on the land and were really doing something out of the love of it. And that's what the entire Cider and Love experience is. It's only makers who are working in that way.
I keep on hearing this, that's called an idiom, iterated about how cider is so great with food.
Yes.
What is it? I mean, I see 8.3% on the label, and it's somewhere in between beer and wine for me. It's also a 500 milliliter bottle, so it's not a huge investment into drinking.
Well, I would say there's a couple of things. First, obviously, you hit on it's accessible. The price points are accessible, and the heritage makers I work with are still, even when you're dealing with the high-end bottles, they're still incredibly affordable when you look at a great bottle of wine. There is also the sessionability, or just the ability to take down a bottle and not feel like that's what your night was about. You know, personally, the rosé all day thing never worked for me, because after rosé all day, I'm like dead by three, you know? and cider is far more accessible. But, you know, there's also just this basic thing that cider has a lot of complexity and a lot of acid in it, often, not always, but it complements food usually quite well. It can bring out the flavors without over dominating, which you can get with some wines that are too alcoholic. They can kind of steamroll your food, or if you have spicy food, it can steamroll it. One of the first things I learned about cider is it pairs really well with delicate foods. Fish, soup. Have you ever had a pairing with soup? Like, but butternut squash soup is so amazing, but I would challenge you to find a wine that pairs as well as a cider does. And you're looking at a harvest beverage. So there is a naturalness to pairing cider with food. It brings out all of the complexity and the fun, and it's very easy to keep playing with it.
And you can find those notes like herbs and grapefruit within a cider itself. Mm-hmm. So it's already referential.
Oh, absolutely.
And I'm already done with this glass.
Well, we're not bringing this glass bottle home. Yeah. So sip up.
I am so smitten, and Jordan has had a lot of this effect on me, with the variety of ciders out there and who you have listed on there. Some of the cideries, like I've had Tilted Shed before from Sonoma. I love two people that you carry, which is Carr's Cider House from Hadley, Mass.
Oh, love.
And Oso Alpenfire from Port Townsend, mm-hmm. for a reason. Well, related, but because they both make really great apple cider vinegars as well.
Oh, yeah.
That are just as expressive as the ciders that they are making. The latitude of what apples can do in this context is mind-blowing to me.
Well, I think that's one of the phrases I'm going to credit him correctly, but Dan Wilson from Slybro said to me that he feels that he's really, the apples are paints that he's using on a canvas. And that I thought was really expressive. There is so much, the same way you can open up a paint box and paint the world, you get the right apples in your orchard and you can really create almost anything you'd like. It's a combination of the apples. It's obviously how they're grown. It's how they're harvested. It's how they're then fermented and how, and then bottled, et cetera, and aged. But all of those individual choices are profoundly artistic. And what I love about it on the site is that you really can have this range and you can be playful. So you can learn. It's great for a tasting. If you want to like buy three bottles and have like a sparkling crisp one to begin, and then you'd like something a little bit maybe fruit forward and semi-dry with your food, and you'd like to finish with something like a pommeau or an ice cider, you have that range. As opposed to, I think one of the saddest things about cider is when people think it's one note. And worse, when it's one note from one pull they had in a pub. You know, sometimes that's a great glass, but sometimes it's not for you. And, you know, like, let's expand that vocabulary, to Jordan's point.
Yeah.
What is this second bottle that we have to expand our palate?
I'm very excited to share this. This is from Liberty. These guys are based out in Spokane. And they actually have a great passion for working with crab apples. They're quite known for that. But this is Stonewall. And it's aged in whiskey barrels. So I just want us to like take a sip, because I've brought it because it's very autumnal. Mm-hmm. So hold on. Ooh, like right off the bat, ooh, gosh, that's so lovely. It's dry. It's subtly sparkling. You can taste the oak. You can taste vanilla. You can almost taste, I would say, a little bit of fruit character, but what's amazing about it is it's dry. I think people have this sense that either sweet is flavor and dry is somehow without flavor. And I think cider and heritage cider really opens up that horizon to say it can be completely dry and yet gorgeous. I mean, this to me would pair so well with, obviously, yes, a traditional pork, but it would also taste incredibly well with, say, roasted pumpkin, not in a pie, but just on its own. And then the tannic quality of this, and, you know, Rick and Austin, if you're listening, apologies, I'm going to go out there and say it, but I would pair this also with dumplings. Like, get your seamless order on. That tannic quality is going to cut right through the sort of greasy, yummy deliciousness of dumplings.
Oh, yeah.
And you could just work with that, right?
I've BYOC'd in Chinatown a lot. Like,
isn't
it works.
That a thing?
Yeah.
I think that's a thing. One of the favorite things, and you were talking about cars, and they do a lot of wild ferment, which gives them a lot of sort of twang, tart, barnyard funk, little sour quality. And we did a tasting recently with a great bottle from Cars, the Wild Apple, and we paired it with samosas. And there's something about the sour tart quality of certain ciders with spicy food. People don't know what to pair with spicy food, but that sour quality really cut through the spice and it brought out the best of both. And so you don't always need to do a like with like pairing. You can kind of do a yin to yang pairing. And I don't want people to feel like you have to be some sort of Martha Stewart with perfect fall, abundant cooking and butternut squash ravioli. You can, you know, whatever's on your takeout menu, you can open up a bottle of cider and it's going to be probably the friendliest bottle you have in your fridge.
I just had an incredible Filipino meal with a whole flight of ciders. And
wow.
Just, again, the spicy food, but not everything was spicy. And there was sweetness in the food. There was heat. There was acidity. And we ended it by pouring the cider down bone marrow.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, transformative. That was one of the best food and drink pairings of my entire life.
That sounds extraordinary. And I can imagine it too, because the character of the cider has enough, you know, you need something that has enough going on. If you have something that's too simplistic, a meal with a lot of complexity and depth, it just doesn't have anything to latch onto. Heritage cider really has that type of complexity. There really is a beginning, middle, and an end that you can unpack. And that goes so well with food. You want a partnership of peers, so to speak. That's awesome. Bone marrow.
Yeah.
Mm. When I don't talk for a while, that usually means I'm really enjoying something.
So what do you think of? We got to give, you know, Rick and Austin their plug. What do you think of Liberty's Stonewall?
Well, you know, with wine, you swirl it around to volatilize the esters. But while this warms up, it opens up in a way, too. And
absolutely.
That, you know, like caramel apple comes out, but not too sweet, like you said. Yeah. And it just has, it's so broad. Mm-hmm. It's rather than just like strikingly acidic and, you know, something that you'd only enjoy if it was really, really cold. It has so much complexity on so many levels.
Yeah, I think that that's some of the playfulness that, you know, cider making is really at the beginning of a renaissance. I think a lot of people are aware that there was a huge leap in cider volumes, you know, in the past 5 years. But what you see now in the heritage cider making world is so many people coming in, not having grown up on a farm, but transitioning into cider making as a second, third, fourth career out of passion, often from a creative background. and they're just beginning to play. You know, in this one, they, you know, have a partnership with Dry Fly. They're making these, you know, they're borrowing the, you know, the barrels to age in. And it's just the beginning. You know, what else can you do? I mean, if this is the start, I can't wait to see where it keeps going, because this is pretty incredible.
Yeah. This is one of the best expressions of oak in cider that I've had. You get the vanilla and the coconut, but it's not... Sometimes the barrel aging in cider, I think, gets a little too boozy, too overwhelming. And this is just so balanced and so special.
And I'm personally somebody who really dislikes Chardonnay. And so I'm always hesitant whenever I start with something that I know is going to have an oak flavor. But there's something here, to your point, where it's completely in its place and feels it feels extremely autumnal because of some of the notes. But yet you can imagine drinking this with... To me, this could be like a really hot summer meal with, you know, it could be Chinese food, it could be Filipino food, it could be something in that palate range with this, and it would somehow sing in a really beautiful way.
This may be the beginning of cider in the context of like the greater scope of American food, cuisine, drink, but it's also the beginning of Cider Week. And we can't go without saying that there are so many great activities happening here in town, and Jordan is certainly curating a lot of those. So I'd love for her to mention how you can get involved, as well as always going to ciderandlove.com and ordering your bottles. What's going on next week, Jordan?
Well, here at Heritage Radio, we have a very exciting event on Monday, November 5th. That is what I've been calling the best day of my life, because it is the overlap of Cider Week in New York City and the Raw Wine Fair. And Dan Pucci and I, along with Heritage Radio and our office home, 100 Bogart, are putting on an event called Co-Ferment, where we're bringing together a conversation of beverage nerds from lots of different drinks and points of view to talk about how they're all pretty much the same. And so that we've got John Reynolds from Black Duck Cidery, Derek Trowbridge from Old World Winery in Sonoma. We have Lauren Grimm from right here in Bushwick from Grimm Artisanal Ales. And then Krista Scruggs, who is a kind of new up-and-coming winemaker in Vermont who didn't get any grapes one year and used apples instead. Awesome. And so we're going to talk about blending these things together in kind of grape, grain, and apple, but also really how the cultures are blended together of how we drink them and how we engage with them.
And if you want to keep your cider separate, don't forget to follow Jordan at Cider Language on Instagram.
Thanks for the shout out.
That's such a great feed. Yeah.
Oh, thank you.
And Annie, one last question, because yes, we've been drinking glasses of cider, but I love how it's incorporated not only into cuisine, but cocktails.
Oh, absolutely. So then I'm going to have to, you know, plug our event next week as well, because it is a fabulous week next week. We're all going to be just very happy. We're hosting something called Adventures and Heritage Cider. It's Tuesday at Bedford Cheese Shop, but don't just think it's cheese. We're going to have dumplings. We're going to have some additional surprises. I don't want to like blow them yet, but they are definitely something you could find on your Seamless takeaway menu, with a bunch of different cider makers, as well as Dan Pucci, as well as Darlene Hayes, who is a mixologist extraordinaire in cider cocktails. So we'll have a cider cocktail there for you to share. And if you're interested in this food and cider pairing and you're trying to get inspiration for the holidays or Thanksgiving or just whatever, follow us on Cider and Love on Instagram. But also our site has articles every single week about how to pair with just about everything. So from Brussels sprouts to Thai food, really, I dare you to find something that's not on the site. But if you see something you'd like to know about, let us know and we'll make an article about it.
Benjamin Franklin once said, "It's bad to eat apples. It is better to turn them all into cider."
That man was a genius.
So heed that warning. Heed that great piece of information and begin drinking your cider now. Thank you, Annie. Thank you, Jordan, for both being on. And get on your Cider Week events next week. A big thank you to Heritage Foods for sponsoring. Order your turkey today. Music by Cookies and Matt Patterson Engineering. Hope to have you back here on the Food Scene next Tuesday at 3. Cheers.
Cheers.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awele, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries, like why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode. Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.